Genesis 24. Genesis chapter 24. Do you like a love story? Maybe, yeah. We got a couple yeses. A couple people like love stories, right? You got a boy that meets a girl, a girl that bumps into a guy, and here we go. This is, in essence, what we have in Genesis chapter 24 here. Now, it takes a while, and that's actually one of the more remarkable parts of this chapter is the amount of time and the amount of energy that is expended into this story. Of all the chapters that we have in Genesis, this is the longest chapter. It's very curious how this works out. And it's also very interesting just to see the emphasis on details that is laid out for us here. But in essence, at the heart of Genesis 24 here is a love story that is playing out. I would argue that it's not simply a love story between Isaac and Rebekah, although that is where we'll end up with. But it's also a love story between God and Abraham. It is a story of sovereignty. It is a story of providence. And I think that is why this story lasts as long as it is, so that our faith is encouraged and we understand who he is like and what he will do and the lengths to which he will go to make these things take place. There's a couple key facts that bring us to chapter 24, and we've seen them over the last couple weeks, but let me, just so we keep everything together and you're with me in your minds, let me just remind you of a couple things that have taken place. If you look back in Genesis 22, and if you look in verses 20 through verse 24, the first fact we have that really builds the foundation for chapter 24 is the fact that Abraham finds out that his brother Nahor has had children. Right, and has had a fair number of children at this point in time. And so what this means, and we don't know how Abraham finds this out, I mean, it's not as if they're talking on the telephone, right? They're not sending emails. They're not probably sending carrier pigeons either, although that's a little more in this realm, right? Somehow they find out, and it's unclear how, but he understands now that there is family that is back in the homeland, right, that has children. Right, that could be eligible for marriage here at this point. So Abraham knows this. Abraham has an understanding of this. The second key fact that brings us to chapter 24 is chapter 23 and the death of Sarah, which we looked at last week. Right, Sarah has finally passed away. Isaac by this point is about 37 years old. If you do the math here. And Abraham is getting quite advanced in age. In fact, when you look at chapter 24 and verse 1, this is exactly the point that is made, right? Verse 1, Abraham was old and advanced in age, right? Abraham is not getting any younger. Now, Abraham is having more children, almost miraculously at this point in time, and we'll get to that next week. But Abraham is not getting any younger. And Isaac, for that matter, is not getting any younger. 37 years old, still does not have a wife. It's about time to get this boy hitched, right? This really does need to happen here at some point. There is a theological point that is underpinning all of these things, right? And this is the crisis that we find ourselves in chapter 24. And this is God able to provide Isaac a wife in order that we can continue to carry out the promised covenantal blessings that God has given to Abraham, okay? This is the crisis that we find ourselves in. Abraham has had a crisis for many years, right? He's had promises that have been given to him. I'm going to make you a mighty nation. I'm going to give you this land. I'm going to pour out all of these blessings upon you and your descendants. But what doesn't have Abraham have? He doesn't have any descendants, right? He doesn't have a single son, and this has been the ongoing crisis of Abraham's life. Well, Isaac is on the scene now, right? We have a solution for that part of the problem, but if Isaac doesn't have a wife, what doesn't Isaac have? Isaac doesn't have a son, right? This is the fundamental problem of Genesis chapter 24. We have Abram about to pass off the scene. In fact, this is really the last major time that we will see Abraham in action. And so it's fitting the way that you see Abraham there at the beginning, and he really just fades off the scene, and attention goes to Isaac. And now we have Isaac sitting there, and he has no wife, and he has no children, right? So how do we remedy this? Is God able to remedy this situation? This is the crisis, and this is what we'll be looking at here in this chapter. As we look at this chapter, we find, as we would expect, that God is quite able to accomplish what he needs to accomplish here. He is able to provide Isaac the wife that he needs, and he's able to do it in remarkable ways. And so for our purposes here this morning, because we have a long chapter and we do not want the sermon to grow in lockstep with how long our chapter is, we're going to focus on the four major characters that we have here this morning, okay? The four major characters that make up and give life to Genesis chapter 24, and that is going to be Abraham. It's going to be Abraham's servant, Laban, and Rebekah. Okay, these four. And as we look at these four, we see the provision of God in all of their lives. All right, we see the way that God is moving and working in all of their lives and the way that he is using them to accomplish what he needs to accomplish, what he wants to accomplish here this morning. Okay, so this is our goal. This is where we're headed, and we'll start looking at this. Before we do this, let's start with a word of prayer, and then we'll start looking at Abraham. Father, again, we thank you for being able to be here this morning. Father, we come to praise you. We come to worship you. And it's chapters like Genesis 24 that strengthen and encourage that worship of you. The more that we see you, the more that we understand who you are, the more that we see your power, your sovereignty, the goodness of your nature, the loving kindness with which you keep covenants and give mercy to individuals. Father, those qualities, those characteristics cause us to love you all the more. They cause us to cling to you all the more. They cause us to run to you all the more. And so, Father, I pray this morning as we look at this chapter where it seems as if there's a very light touch being given on your part, I pray that we see how heavily you are moving here, how much activity is going on here, and how you are bringing all these things to pass. So give us grace for that this morning. Cause us to worship you. Cause us to love you as a result, and may you be glorified as we look at this. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. All right, so Genesis 24, let me start looking here in verse 1, and let's think first about Abraham and his role in this saga here. So chapter 24, verse 1, Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. But you will go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac. A servant said to him, suppose the woman is not willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land from where you came? Then Abraham said to him, beware that you do not take my son back. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, to your descendants I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this my oath. Only do not take my son back there. So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham his master and swore to him concerning this matter. So as Abraham is coming on the scene here, we're transitioning between Abraham and Isaac, and this chapter really forms that boundary. We have Abraham carrying out what we know to be really his last major act. We will learn more about Abraham in the next chapter as we understand that he's having more children and sending them away. But this is his last major act, and he's acting here as the father, right? He is the father of Isaac, and he is concerned over his son. He is concerned over his son having a wife. He is concerned over that he needs to have descendants that this covenant blessing can continue to pass on to. And so he turns to his most trusted servant, looks what would appear to be his eldest servant in the house, and he looks to him and says, I need you to come here. We have an urgent task that needs to be handled, okay? This task will not be quick. This task will not be easy. In fact, it probably takes place there's a three-year window, and we don't know how long it takes over the 3 years, but there's about a three-year window this has taken place in. And this mission is going to be absolutely critical to keeping everything to take place. You'll notice there that the oath that is being made, right? His hand is being stuck under his thigh. This is a very intimate situation. This is a very intimate scene, and this really leans heavily towards emphasizing how much this is on Abraham's mind. Right, this is near and dear to Abraham, and he's making that point to the servant. Right, you need to understand how important this is. You need to understand what is going on here. As far as Abraham is concerned, there are two main things that he is most concerned with here at this point in time. Number one, Isaac must not marry a Canaanite woman. Isaac must not marry a Canaanite woman. You can see this being very clear here in the middle of verse 3. You shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, right? This absolutely cannot happen. Now, what's less clear is why. It's less clear to us why Abraham is so concerned about this. I think it's quite possible, and probably more likely, that Abraham is concerned with the conflict that would take place if you are taking some of his descendants who are meant to have this land with some of the descendants of the land who are not supposed to have the land anymore. Right? You have Canaanites who are going to lose this land eventually, and you have Abraham's seed, which is going to inherit this land eventually. Do you create a conflict by creating some kind of a union between the two? Right? I think I suspect, because I don't have any other revelation to prove this up, I suspect this is probably Abraham's main concern at this point in time. Right? This would seem to be an incompatible idea. Right? We would create problems. It's also possible that Abraham is concerned about idolatry. When we look at later instruction that is given to the children of Israel, and later instruction, especially that Moses is given to the children of Israel, they are instructed specifically not to marry with the people of the land. And the primary concern being that the people of the land, those ladies, are gonna bring their gods with them. That's how they were raised. That's how they were instructed. This is what they know. And if you bring that in, eventually you will begin to be swayed toward that kind of worship. And you will step away from the worship of Jehovah. And you will step away towards idolatry. And you will step away towards judgment. It is possible, given Abraham's situation, that Abraham feels that as well. Right, it's entirely possible that Abraham senses if you allow these marriages to take place, there's going to be problems, and we do not want to jeopardize the inheritance, and we do not want to jeopardize the blessings that God has promised. There's a third possibility that I could think that could be driving Abraham's motivations at this point, and that may be the people of the land. This may be very different and very difficult to get along with. You can imagine Abraham is used to living in a certain culture, which is much farther away from here. They would have had their cultures. They would have had their traditions. They would have had their way of looking at things. He has come into a land that is different, right? It's not that it is different agriculturally or even in many other ways, but this is a different land. There are different cultures. There are different things that are going on here. And when you look in Genesis later on, in Genesis 27, verses 46, and in 26, verse 35, as Rebekah and Isaac are finding themselves in a very similar situation, we find that the women that Esau married, which were Hittites, they were women in this area, sons of the sons of Heth that were in this area, they are a grief both to Isaac and to Rebekah. Rebekah will later even express that I am weary with these two ladies that Esau has married. And there's no reference to idolatry, there's no reference to anything else. It would almost just appear that there is just some kind of a cultural difference between the people that are living here and what these individuals are expecting from their homeland, and it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work, right? This simply cannot happen. This is not going to be pleasant. And so it may simply be that Abraham is looking and saying, Isaac needs to have someone like us, right? He needs to have someone that has the same basic understanding, the same basic societal practices that we have right now. That will make life easier. So it's entirely possible this is what Abraham is considering, but we don't know, okay? So he is convinced that Isaac must not marry a Canaanite. And number two, he is utterly convinced that Isaac should not go back to where Abraham came from. Right? You see this come up in the conversation with the servant. When the servant says, well, if she doesn't want to come, should I take Isaac back to go meet her? And Abraham is emphatic. Beware that you do not do this. Right? He couldn't possibly be stronger in his warning. This absolutely cannot happen. And why can't that happen? Has Isaac been promised that land back there? No, where is Isaac's land? It's going to be right where they are right now, right? If Isaac goes back to where Abraham came from, what's going to be the temptation? Stay here, right? Your wife is from here. You have ancient roots back in this area. It'll be easier. It'll be better maybe even. Things might even be easier economically and socially if you come back to this area. Abraham understands and realizes the danger of Isaac leaving Canaan to go back to the land where he came from. And he says specifically, you cannot leave. You cannot take Isaac back. I can't help but wonder if Abraham is not thinking about the times that he has left the land of Canaan in recent history. Every time that we have seen Abraham leave the land of Canaan for some reason or another, things have gone terribly wrong, right? Because that is not where Abraham was meant to be. And Abraham may very well be simply thinking about to Isaac and simply saying to Isaac, listen, I have made mistakes and I don't wish for you to make the same, right? You stay here. Right, you stay where you're meant to be, where you're supposed to be. This is the land that we are going to inherit. Even if all we own is a field and a cave right now, you stay right here because this land is promised to us. Because of these two concerns, the servant is given explicit instructions. Right, you are to go to the land where I've come from. So presumably Abraham is going to tell him, hey, this is how you get there. This is the land that you're looking for. These are the people that you're looking for. I'm sure this conversation is longer than what we have right here. This is just the condensed version, right? To let us know what the servant is charged with and to let us know how important this is to Abraham here. But as we look at the way that Abraham describes this, it's clear to me that Abraham is believing certain things about this experience. After the servant expresses concern in verses 5, and Abraham stresses in verse 6, you cannot take Isaac back, Abraham leans in on verse 7, and we see this: the Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, to your descendants I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. Now, this expression, this idea that he will send his angel before you, where does Abraham get this from? How does he know that a servant, that an angel is going to be sent in front of this servant to prepare the way, to bring success to the journey, to guide the servant to where he needs to go, to the wife that needs to be gotten? How does Abraham know this? It's possible that we had revelation, isn't it? Again, we don't know everything about Abraham's life. We're simply given snapshots at any given point in time. It's possible that God has revealed himself to Abraham at some point and said, listen, it's time. You need to go get a wife for Isaac. I am preparing things for you in advance, right? Send your servant. Tell him to get some camels together. Head out over there. Everything is going to be okay. It's entirely possible to me that that is what is taking place here. But if you look back earlier in verse 7, think about what he's saying there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, to your descendants, I will give this land. What really is Abraham doing here? Abraham is really calling back to mind. Abraham is going back and thinking, look at all the things that God has done for me so far. Look at the journey that I have been on. Look at the way that I have been led to this date, right? God has appeared to me. He has called me. He has given me instructions to come all the way from the land that I came to this land. I didn't know anything about this land. I wasn't interested in this land. I wasn't just coming here to be a tourist here, right? I have been through a lot. Think about all of the deliverances that God has provided to Abraham that we know of. Right, every way that God has guided Abram through all this, he successfully brought Sarah out of two very bad situations, both of which Abraham has caused. He has brought him through battles with kings who should not have been beat by Abraham, right? And that has happened well. You look at Isaac now. Isaac standing in front of him, right? Is that not an answer to prayer? Is that not a provision that God has made for Abram, right? And God has given to Abraham all these promises, right? To your descendants, I will give this land. When I see this expression at the end, that he will send his angel before you, I tend to think that it may not have been revelation that was given to Abraham to lead him to this conclusion. I tend to think this is the faith of someone who has finally matured in his faith, expressing what he knows to be true. And that is that I have seen God act in this situation, and in this situation, and in this situation, and in this situation, and in this situation. And now that I find myself here on the edge of a new situation, a new crisis, right? Who is my son going to marry? How is my son going to have a seed? He no longer is finding himself thinking, what do I need to do? He's no longer looking at trying to provide a solution like maybe he did with Hagar. He's now looking and saying, same God who has provided and has somehow led and has somehow provided and has somehow paved every road of my experience will likewise do the same for you and for my son as well. I think this is a faith that is mature that is speaking here. This is someone who is seasoned. This is someone who has come to understand how God works. This is someone who has come to understand two truths, and that is the sovereignty of God and the providence of God. The sovereignty of God and the providence of God. Those are two different ideas, but they are interwoven and almost impossible to separate. Right? God has been exceptionally providential towards Abraham. Right? Look at all the blessings that God has given to Abraham. Right? All the blessings that have been promised. Look at all the ways in which God has provided for Abraham. Right? Pulling him out of scrape after scrape after scrape. Some that were caused by his own doing and some that weren't caused by his own doing. And yet God has provided all of these ways. And God has been able to do that because he is sovereign. He is able to do that because he is sovereign. He is able to pull together the resources that is needed when they are needed to solve a particular problem. You and I are different, right? I could be feeling providential. I may be good-natured and disposed to help you, but eventually I run into limits, right? Eventually I just don't have enough resources for certain situations. Eventually there's not enough time. Eventually I don't have the authority to make something happen. This is out of my hands. With God, that is never true. Right? And so that providential nature of God combined with the sovereignty of God is phenomenal. And I think Abraham by this point in time has come to a knowledge of that. And he comes to rest in that. And all he knows, he probably has no way of knowing what that angel was doing. He has no way of knowing who that wife could possibly be. He has no way of knowing how long it will take. He has no idea the conversations the servant will have. But what he does know is that there is no limits to what God can do to make this thing happen. And he will make it happen, right? And so in Abraham, what you have here, you have a faith that is mature. You have a faith that has become strong. And I think for us, that's a very good example to see, is it not? Because we have seen Abraham when he's not in that situation. We have seen Abraham when his faith is weak. We have seen Abraham waver time and time again. And now we see him come to a point where he is mature. He is strong. He does not have all of the answers. He does not know how this is going to work out. But he knows that God will make this work out. And he can rest in that. And he can trust in that. This is exactly where you and I need to be going. Right? This is exactly the degree to which we should be trying to achieve. Right? Is that we come to a place where we do not have the answers. We do not know everything or how it will turn out. But we trust in the sovereign nature of God. We trust in his character. We trust in his attributes. We trust in his loving kindness, right? This is where Abraham is at this point in his life, and this is a good place to be, right? And this will work out very well because the faith is where it ought to be. So Abraham here, bringing faith to this scene as we look at the crisis that is unfolding. So let's look now at the servant, right? Because the servant is the one, frankly, that has to do all the legwork. Abraham is old. He's not going to be traveling. Abraham probably doesn't want to leave the land of Canaan for the reasons we've already just described here, right? This does not tend to work out well. And so the servant is going to be dispatched, and off the servant goes. What's curious is we don't know who this servant is. We have no idea. A good guess would have been the Eliezer that is mentioned back in chapter 15 and verse 2. But remember, this has been a very long time in between. It's quite possible that Eliezer is off the scene by this point in time. And the fact that we don't have a name that is given, when you do bother to give the name Eliezer before, makes us think this is probably just another servant, right? This is another senior servant that is inside the house. He is trusted very highly and given this very clear task. And off the servant goes. We see him in verses 10. He begins to gather the resources that he needs for this trip. He gathers 10 camels. He is gathering a variety of things from the house. And it will become clear what he is gathering as we move through the story. But he's bringing along treasures. No doubt he's bringing along provisions for the journey. This is going to be a long journey. I'm sure he's bringing along enough funds to be exchanged for more goods as he goes along the way. Abraham is a wealthy man, and this servant is able to pull off of that bounty as he looks for this journey. Right? He begins to make his journey. We see in verse 10, the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand, and he arose and went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of the water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. He said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show me loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the women are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please draw down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also. May she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master. The servant makes it to where he needs to go, right? To the city of Nahor, there where Abraham is from. He's made a long journey. Again, we don't know how long it's taken, so there's some editing that's taking place here. But he's made it to where he needs to get. And starting in verse 12, we have the very first prayer for guidance that we have in all of Scripture, right? And it comes not from Abraham, it comes not from Isaac, but it comes from this servant here. And think about what this servant is asking for here. O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. To my master Abraham. What is curious to me is that as far as we know, there is no relationship between this servant and God. Now, there may be, but when you see this prayer right here, is that the first thing you think of? Right? O Lord, the God of my master, Abraham? Is it his God? Doesn't seem to be. It's Abraham's God, right? No doubt this servant knows who this Abraham's God is, because no doubt Abraham is talking about this. But this servant doesn't have a relationship with God that we know of. This servant isn't given any promises by God. Right? This servant isn't given the land of Canaan. The servant is just a servant in the house of Abraham. He's just another cog in the wheel, if you will, right? He's just a servant. He's just there taking care of things for Abraham. He's trusted. He's obviously trustworthy for this matter, but he has no relationship, right? This servant's entire relationship with God is based off of Abraham's relationship with God. This is the fascinating thing about this servant, right? He is sent on a journey that would require great faith, that is going to require a great deal of time, that is going to require a great deal of effort. It means nothing to the servant, right? The servant isn't getting a wife. The servant's son isn't getting a wife. Everything is for Abraham. Everything is for Isaac. The relationship is with Abraham. The relationship is with Isaac. The covenant is with Abraham. The covenant is with Isaac. This servant is just there. He's just a witness. He's just a part of this scene. And I guarantee you by the end of this story, this servant believes God just as much as Abraham believes God. Right? Because of the way this situation unfolds. But it starts off solely on this person's knowledge of Abraham's relationship with God. And this is one of the things that I love about this story so much, because this should describe situations that we find with individuals that we come across. We have a faith in God. We trust in God. We have a relationship with God. And yet we have relationships. We have interactions with individuals who do not have those relationships. What do they learn from us? What do they see in us about God? The servant here represents what is, I think, the ideal situation that should look like, right? He is able to see God's working in the life of Abraham. He is able to see God's providence in the life of Abraham, and he draws from it. He's even willing to pray based off of this fact. And this prayer is not going to be disappointed. The prayer that he unfolds is quite a remarkable one, right? He's made it to the city. He's probably tired. He's probably thirsty by this point in time. His camels are probably tired. His camels are probably thirsty. And he sets out this sign that is going to take place here. And the sign is twofold, right? The woman that comes out to him, the girl that comes out to him and offers him something to drink and his camels also, may this be the one. Now, the first part of that sign is fairly reasonable, right? That is fairly reasonable. This should be a culture that is characterized by hospitality. It would not have been uncommon for someone to have seen a stranger here and to extend here, have some water from this well, have some water from this jar. The second one, that's a tall order. Camels drink a lot of water. Camels drink a lot of water. And we don't just have one camel. We have 10 camels. You may be willing to extend yourself for the sake of one thirsty traveler, But are you really willing to expend yourself for the sake of 10 thirsty camels? The answer normally is going to be no, right? And that would probably be true of her just as much as it probably would be true of you or I, right? This is a very tall order that is being laid out here. And yet this is the sign the servant lays out. If both of these things are true, then I will know that this is the woman that you have laid out for us here. And as this scene unfolds, we have these three progressions that take place. We have the servant's prayer here in verses 10 through 14. We have the servant's waiting in verses 15 down through 21. And then we have the servant rejoicing down in verses 26 and 27. As the servant is sitting there, notice in verse 15, before he had finished. Okay, so the servant is praying this prayer. He's praying to this God who he doesn't necessarily have a relationship with. Abraham has this relationship with. He's praying this would be answered. He closes at the end of verse 14, "By this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master." Right? Again, the emphasis is not on him, it is on his master. Verse 15, before he had finished speaking. Right, this is a snappy story here, right? Everything is falling into place. Everything is happening exactly as it should, exactly when it needs to. Who shows up? It's Rebecca. And Rebecca begins to carry out everything that the servant has asked for in this sign. She not only offers water to this thirsty servant who is standing here by the well, but she is willing to offer and to draw water for 10 camels. And mind you, this was not a quick task. These camels are thirsty. These camels are capable of drinking a lot of water. She's going back to the well over and over and over and over again. And I think this is probably why in verse 21, we see this second stage here, right? As the servant is waiting. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord has made his journey successful or not. This young lady is putting an awful lot of effort into this. Right, she is expending an awful lot of effort to feed these thirsty camels. But what don't we know? Whose daughter is she? We know she's hospitable, right? This girl gets an A+ for effort, but we don't know if she's the right line. Right? And so this mini crisis sit here unfolds, and the servant just sits here gazing in silence. Is this really it? Has God really answered my prayer? Could this really be the wife? This is exceptional, right? The scene that is unfolding in front of me is exceptional. Most normal women, most normal girls would not be willing to do this, but here she is. But is this really the one? Right? So verse 22, when the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing half a shekel and two bracelets. This is quite a gift, by the way. For her wrist weighing 10 shekels in gold, and said, "Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house?" Whose daughter are you? Right? She said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." Again she said to him, "We have both plenty of straw and feed and room to lodge in." The man bowed low and worshipped the Lord, and he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers." The servant has prayed, the servant has waited, and now the servant is rejoicing because what has happened? God has done exactly what Abraham said would happen, right? An angel has gone forward. An angel has led the way, not only for the safe journey for the servant through a situation that would have been long and perilous, but now he has led him straight to the well that he needed to go to, straight immediately to the girl that he was looking for, and straight immediately to the girl who is of the right house, the right family, right? It's key here, right? The Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness, right? It was the loving kindness that he was praying based off of earlier. And now he says, this is the loving kindness proved, right? God has done exactly what I have prayed for. God has exactly met the requirements that Abraham has laid out. He has done exactly what he has said. And he is praising God. Again, this servant had no relationship that we know of before. But now there is, right? He knows and he understands exactly who God is. He understands his character. And this has moved from a servant whose relationship, who's based with God, is based off of Abraham, to a servant whose relationship with God is based off of his own experience. He has seen it with his own two eyes. He has experienced it. He knows it and understands what is going on here. A servant is remarkable. The third person that comes on the scene now is Laban. Laban begins to come on the scene. Rebecca has made it clear that, and we know based off the fact that she has completed the sign and the fact that she has made known her heritage, we now know that this is the girl that we're looking for. We have been looking for Rebecca. We now know that Rebecca has made an offer there in verse 25, saying, "We have plenty of straw, we have plenty of room, we have plenty of food. You should be able to come on. You should be able to come on over." Now, she doesn't actually extend the offer, but she's made it clear that that should be something that could take place. She rushes off in verse 28, and you can imagine she probably would, right? After she gets this nose ring, after she has this this very expensive bracelet that is given to her, she's probably a little worked up herself, right? This is not a normal day at the well, okay, right? This is a little bit unusual and a little bit exciting. So off she runs, okay? Off she runs back to her house, and who's waiting for her? Verse 29. Now, Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban, and Laban ran outside to the man at the spring. When he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrist, and when he heard the words of Rebekah, his sister, saying, "This is what the man said to me." He went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. And he said, "Come in, blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside, since I have prepared the house and a place for the camels?" So the man entered the house. Laban comes on the scene, and Laban invites the servant who is still remaining at the well. He invites the servant to come back to the house. Come, stay with us. Now, you'll notice there in verse 30, what is it that got Laban's attention? Now, he has heard the words, right? He's heard what Rebecca has said, right? The conversation, she's rehearsed it. But notice what first is mentioned. When he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrist, what does Laban see? Laban sees dollar signs, right? Laban sees dollar signs, right? There are dollar signs in Laban's eyes as soon as Rebecca comes back with this bracelet and with this nose ring, right? That is all that Laban sees. This is interesting to us because this is not the last time that we will see Laban. And when we see Laban the next time, we will understand that Laban is very much motivated by what he can get, right? And very frustrated by what he loses, okay? We are already establishing Laban's character, and the author of Genesis has done a good job of making sure that you understood it was the bracelets and the ring that he saw first, right? This is what really catches attention. And so this introduction that he gives in verse 31, "Come in, blessed of the Lord," this is something that you would greet a wealthy person with, right? In other words, "Hey, money bags, come on in," right? Why don't you come on in our house? Why don't you walk on in here? We are so glad to have you, right? This is exactly the kind of attitude that Laban is bringing to the situation, right? He sees money. He understands that there's money involved. And if there's a way to get it, he's quite interested in getting to it. He invites the servant in. He does. He is hospitable. We'll give Laban that, right? He brings the servant inside. He gives him food. He gets him to sit down at the table, wants him to start eating, taking care of the camels. And the servant says, no. Hold on. I got a mission, right? I've got a mission, and this mission has to be carried out. And so the servant really begins in verse 34 all the way down to verse 44, begins to lay out again and rehearse everything that has happened, right? And we've already looked at this, so I'm going to skip over a good bit of this, right? But this is exactly what we have seen, right? Abraham has sent the servant on a mission. The servant has made it to the city. We found Rebecca. She's done everything that she's supposed to do, right? And so the servant begins to rehearse everything that is going on here. In verse 49, we get to the crux of the matter, right? This is, again, another crisis point that we find. "So now, right, if you are going to deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me, and if not, let me know, that I may turn to the right hand or to the left." Okay? We have been through several crises already, right? Are we going to be able to find this girl, right? Are we going to be able to land there safely? Are we going to be able to get all these things? And all of these things are working out, right? Servant has made it to the city. We have found Rebecca pretty much immediately. She's fulfilled the sign. She has the right heritage, right? Everything is looking well. But we come to the problem that the servant raised when he was talking to Abraham. What if she doesn't want to come back? Right? What if she doesn't want to come with me? Right? And this is now where the servant is. Will you do what needs to be done? Right? Very clearly, I have told you, based on this story, this is the girl that it's supposed to be. Are you going to let me have her or not? Right? This is what I came for. I didn't come for a meal. I came for this. right? And we see in verse 50 that the answer is really quite, there's absolutely no resistance that is given. And again, I suspect this is due to the bracelet and the nose ring. Laban and Bethuel replied, "The matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you bad or good. Here is Rebekah before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken." When Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself to the ground before the Lord. This servant brought out articles of silver and articles of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah, and he gave also precious things to her brother and to her mother. All right? This is tradition for this point in time. This is what would typically take place. If you were arranging a marriage, if you were getting all of these things together, you would make the agreement, and then there would be gifts that would be given out. And so I'm going to be honest with you, based off of what we know from verse 30 and the imagery that we get of Laban there, I'm going to suspect very strongly that verse 50 is probably also motivated by money. The fact that he's willing to say, "Oh, I can't say anything good or bad about this proposal that you have come to," and immediately we find out that we have gifts being given specifically to the brother and to the mother, I think it is probably reasonable to assume that while they probably have a general trust for the situation that is going on, the primary desire is going to be the finances. Laban understands very well where this is going. Laban understands how this tradition works. He lives here. He's grown up here. He understands what's coming, right? And he is expecting that if my sister has already gotten that just for watering some camels, what are we going to get for getting her for a wife, right? And Laban is more than happy to say, "Sounds good. Have her," right? She's yours, right? And so this is Laban, right? And what do we learn from Laban, right? We don't get an overly favorable view of Laban, do we? Now, he's not an awful guy. He's hospitable, right? Maybe he was good looking. We don't know, right? But he is certainly motivated by money, right? And yet, is God able to use that? He is. Right? Here is someone that doesn't necessarily meet our standards for morality. Right? This is not someone that you would admire. This is not someone that you would have a great deal of respect for. For Rebekah, she's really just a paycheck to Laban at this point in time. Right? He knows he's going to get gifts, and that's perfectly fine with him. Right? It's okay. Send her off. Send her away. Where's the gifts? Where are the kicks back coming in? Right? And yet God is able to use that. And this is the third thing that we see from this story. Not only is God able to use someone like Eliezer, who has really no relationship with God, but God is able to take someone who does not have any relationship with God at all. No interest in him whatsoever. Even hostile, right? Even acting in a way that is contrary to the way that we would expect someone to behave and the way that God would ask for someone to behave. And yet God is able to take them and use them to accomplish his will as well. Right? Because that's exactly what Laban is doing here, right? He is conceding to everything that is being asked of him, right? For motivations that are less than good. But God is able to do this. God's sovereignty, God's providence is not bounded by men, right? He can take good men and use them. He can take bad men and use them equally as he sees fit, right? This is how the sovereignty of God is not bounded in any way, and this is how the providence of God is able to be exceedingly abundantly above all that we can ask or think. Now, this brings us lastly to Rebekah, right? Our last major player here. Now, Rebekah, we shouldn't really say the last major player because we've already seen Rebekah, right? Rebekah's already put up a pretty good hustle for the day, honestly. She's been very busy, right? And we have a lot that we could say that is good about Rebekah. The hospitality is the first thing that we would notice, right? We've seen hospitality come up several times already in Genesis. We've seen it come up in Abraham. We've seen it come up in the person of Lot, right? Hospitality has been something that Genesis has focused on time and time again. And here we have Rebekah being hospitable. And I think it's fitting the servant was asking for that. And I think it's fitting that the wife for Isaac should be that way, right? This is a fitting characteristic for a family that is characterized by this kind of behavior. Now that the decision has been made that Rebekah is going to be given over to the servant, is going to be given to Isaac as a wife, we have our final crisis that emerges here, right? The servant is very pleased with what happens. Obviously, he hands out the gifts. Verse 54, they spend the evening eating and drinking together, right? This is a cause for great celebration. And in verse 54, when the next morning comes, the servant again arises with his predictable focus and says, "Send me away now. right? As soon as he came to this city, he said, I don't care about eating. I don't care about that. Let's skip the meal. Hold off on the meal. Let's get down to business, right? This is what I came here for. The next morning, what is he doing? Let's get down to business. This is what I came here for, right? I did not come to stay with you for a month. I came with for you to get a wife for Isaac and to go back home, right? And that's what I'm going to go do. And so he says, send me away, right? Send me away that I can go back to the master. Verse 55, we have a roadblock that emerges here. But her brother and her mother said, let the girl stay with us a few days, say 10, and afterwards she may go. He said to them, do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master. And they said, we will call the girl and consult her wishes. Then they called Rebekah and said to her, will you go with this man? And she said, I will go. Again, the crisis emerges. We have gone from crisis to crisis. We need a wife for Isaac. We need to find the right wife for Isaac. We need to find a family that is willing to give their daughter to give to Isaac. And now we come to the crisis of, will this daughter really go to Isaac? Right? Will she really do it? Because the choice has been utterly laid at her feet. The servant wants to go. The servant wants to get about his business. He doesn't have time to dilly-dally. Abraham is old, right? We've got to get back there and get back there soon. Isaac isn't getting any younger. We need to get back there and get back there soon. Let me go, right? They want to dally for a little bit. I think it's possible this is Laban at work again, right? If this girl has to be given a choice, does she really want to go? She's got a few days now to think about it at that point, right? We've made an agreement, but what will we probably keep? We'll probably keep the stuff, right? This is probably Laban at work here, maybe hoping we could kind of renegotiate this deal a little bit. Maybe we could up the ante here in 10 days to really make sure that she goes with us, right? Servant isn't going to have any of it, right? They lay the choice before Rebekah. Will you go? Can you imagine Rebekah's thought process at that point in time? Does she know Isaac? Does she know Abraham? Does she know where she's going? Has she ever left the city before? It seems highly unlikely. You're asking this girl, who's fairly young probably still at this point in time, to leave everything that she has ever known, to leave everyone that she has ever known, to go a place that she does not know, to become married to someone that she does not know, right? This is the choice that you lay out before her, right? Will you do this thing, right? And what's remarkable in this situation is that in this situation, Rebekah really mirrors the faith of Abraham more than anyone else that you will see in Abraham's family at this point in time. She mirrors the faith of Abraham. She is willing to leave her father's house. She is willing to leave her father's land. She is willing to go to a place that she does not know, right? To marry someone that she's never seen before, only heard of just recently, right? Even that this person even exists. She is willing to do all of these things. Why? Where does Abraham's faith come from? Does it come from him? Did Abraham conjure up all this faith? No. So where does Rebekah's faith come? It doesn't come from her, right? God is working in her heart to bring her to this same kind of faith, right? Absence of revelation like Abraham got, right? God is still capable of moving in her in this way, of directing her in this way, and she is willing to take a step that is remarkable. Rebekah probably does not get enough credit. We probably look more of her finagling that happens later on as we look at the sons. But here, she is a model example of what faith looks like. Willing to forsake everything. Willing to let everything go because this is the path that has been laid out before her, right? She trusts it. She must trust something at some point. And I have to suspect she believes in God at this point in time, having heard the story as it has been laid out to her in the situation. And she is moved with faith and she goes. She leaves here, right? Rebekah becomes a worthy addition to Abraham's house. Rebekah becomes someone who is hospitable, someone who is clearly has energy that can be given, someone that has strength of character that will be needed in the days to come as there are struggles between Esau and between Jacob. This is someone that Isaac very much needs, and God has made sure that this is the woman that would be provided for him here, right? Rebekah is a remarkable example of faith when she is put on the spot, and her simple answer is, I will go. No hesitation, no ifs, no ands, no buts. She goes, right? And this changes everyone's mind, right? No, Laban no longer has the opportunity to try to renegotiate. He doesn't have an opportunity to pull out of the deal. They send her away with some servants. They bless her in verse 60, and off she goes. And again, if you love a good love story, where do we end up? Right? After they begin that journey and they make their way back to where Isaac was, to where Abraham should still be at this point in time, right? Isaac is walking out in the field, verses 62 through 67. It's really quite dramatic, isn't it? He's out there just kind of meditating in the field, thinking about things, and she sees him and he sees her. And what is it? Love. All right, it's love. What better ending could you ask for in a story than this? But who's behind it? It's God. God has been behind it all the way along. Through different characters, with different motivations, with different mindsets, with different backgrounds, with a whole host of situations that really are arrayed against them. Right? God is the one who has provided. God is the one who has sovereignly ordered all of these things to take place. God is the one who has made the provision. Even Isaac himself, you'll notice I'm not throwing him in as a major character, because what does he do? He's simply the recipient. Right? Someone else has done all of the work, whether it's a servant, whether it's Rebecca, whether it's everyone else. Someone else has done all the work, and Isaac is simply the recipient of someone that he can love, right? And it is all God's work. It is all his providence. It is a testimony to his sovereignty. And this, I would submit, is the reason why this chapter is so long, right? It's not simply because God loves a good love story and wants to really encourage us with one. It's because God wants us to understand who he is. He wants us to understand his sovereignty. He wants us to understand his providence so that we get to the point that Abraham was at the beginning of the story, right? I trust him. I trust him fully without any reservations, knowing that he is capable of doing exactly what he has promised that he would, right? This is the point of Genesis 24. This is the point of this love story. The love story is secondary. It's God's love story to Abraham that is first, right? That is a lesson for us as we go out. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for what you've given us here in this chapter. Father, we thank you for this story. Father, it is beautiful. It is beautiful in the way that it is laid out, the way that all of the pieces fall into play, the way that Isaac is comforted by Rebecca. It is beautiful in its depiction. But Father, it is far more beautiful in the theological truths that are being shown for us here, Father, that you are a God who is sovereign, that you are a God who is providential, and that you can and you will carry out the promises that you have made. Even if we don't understand what that looks like, even if the odds are long, even if we are dealing with individuals whose motivations are not like ours in any respect, you are capable of using them and working in them to bring them to that point to accomplish your will. Father, for us, that is a comfort. Father, for you, that is glory. And so we thank you for that, and we praise you for that here this morning. Just then, I pray. Amen.